back to On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. I am Hannah Stanley, and this is part three of our episode of the impossibly lonely work of policing. I'm joined today with Brian Warner, an 18-year veteran of the Chicago Police Department and founder of the organization Chicago Police Survivors. Before we chat with Brian, I want to remind you to make sure to subscribe to our podcast on Social Health and Change. You can do that via the WGN Plus app, or you can do that anywhere you download your podcast. Just hit subscribe and they will populate automatically and you won't miss an episode. Now, Brian, thank you, of course, for coming in and sitting and talking with me. Of course. Now, you were medically retired from the department. Can you lead us through the events that led to that, please?
First of all, thank you for using that terminology. That's something the medically retired. That's something that the department does not use. They consider me disabled, which I don't feel disabled.
Even
officers who I talk to, I mean, my injury is psychological. So I walk into a room and I'm 6'3", 200 pounds. I look healthy. I am healthy, but I have emotional scars. So people don't understand, oh, you're on disability. Are you trying to work the system? What is it that just from that category alone, from that labeling, and even officers who have catastrophic injuries or in wheelchairs are still productive members, and they feel a stigma to being labeled as disabled as well. And it's one of the simple things I've asked the department to do, print up a new ID, put a new label on it. I think it's I don't want to sound politically correct again because that term is overused, but I think just from an emotional standpoint, it would be something that would go a long way.
To say medically retired.
Medically retired opposed to disabled.
Okay. And in the military, is that...
The military, I believe, uses that term.
Because so much of the of police work and how it's structured is based on military.
It is. And unfortunately, the PTSD, the military, it's been around forever. Post-traumatic stress has been around forever. It was in the Civil War. It was called battle fatigue. It was in World War II. It was called shell shock. It's been around forever. Post-traumatic stress is the latest term they use for it. And the military is just only starting addressing it 10 years ago, possibly. And then the local municipality, Chicago and New York and all the other places will jump on board. But they take their cue from the military. So if the military is just catching up, we're many, many years behind.
Mm. All right. Considering what we've just talked about, PTSD, the military is now starting to offer tremendous amounts of help. Lots of research going into this. Were you offered help to cope with yours?
Unfortunately, the resources we had when I went through my incident in 2011, I was involved in a shooting where I was shot in the line of duty, returning fire, killing the offender who shot me. My partner and I were both mandated to go to one session at our Chicago Police Employee Assistance.
That's mandated for one.
One. You're 3 days off to take time to figure out what happened, and then one session is all that's required. I've tried to broaden that. I've gone to the department and asking them to advance on it. Dr. Cook talked about the National Chiefs of Police. They have a protocol for officer-involved shootings. We're not reinventing the wheel. All I'm asking is that we implement some of these things. Most recently, because of the whole high-profile shootings, they've taken officers off the street for 30 days. That's a step in the right direction. That's one of the things we've been asking for in the survivors group, is that you take them off, but monitor them, you know, for that 30 days. Don't just take them off and make them feel as if they're being disciplined. They're already feeling vulnerable enough because they've taken a life. They're being scrutinized in the media. They're being scrutinized by the politicians, being scrutinized by everybody, people who don't even have the facts. This officer's reeling enough. I mean, it's a human being who's already just taken another human being's life. There's no way you can punish him more than he or she's already punishing themselves.
Because if there isn't scrutiny, if there isn't the media coverage, if it's very understandable, everybody gets it, they're still dealing with the trauma of those actions.
Correct. Instead, it was a justified shooting. Obviously, the person shot me first, but it could have went a totally different direction based on the media. The day of the shooting that occurs 5 o'clock in the evening, the media reached out to one of the family members of the person I was in the shootout with. And that evening, the family member said something to the effect, doesn't surprise me. My brother was mentally ill. He was off his meds. He was self-medicating. We had to move our mother away from him because he was stealing her goods to buy his drugs, and just tells the facts. The next day, that same person is on TV because the lawyers reached out to him, crying, literally crying, saying if the police would have done their job, if they would have done this, would have done that, and changing all the facts altogether. So by the grace of God, and the media wasn't blowing in a direction where there was another high-profile case, I could be one of these officers that are being thrown to the wolves today.
Okay, so when you went to your one mandated appointment.
Correct.
And then tell me what was next. Did you go on to desk duty? Did you find someone on your own?
No, there was no requirement for desk duty. My partner and I returned to work. I was actually had a scheduled for a LOA vacation. I went on that 2-week vacation. In the meantime, my partner went to work every day. Then when I returned from my 2-week vacation, the two of us went to the counseling session together. We talked to the woman for an hour or so. Our session ended. I knew I needed more help. I grabbed her card. I went back a handful of times. Didn't feel as if I was getting my needs filled. Some things happened that didn't really. I lost confidence in that system.
In the support system.
In that support system.
Okay.
Yes. So I stopped going there, and I just blew in the wind for several months, just self-medicating, drinking too much, and doing things that were I thought were cries for help, hoping that somebody may notice and say, what is it that you need? That went on for several months, and then my partner retired, and the partner who I was in the critical incident with, and then things really went south.
Now, he retired based on the time to retire.
Right. He'd already planned on retirement before our shooting. He was coming of the age where he was going to be mandatory retired anyway. He was going to leave the department. It had nothing to do with the shooting. It wasn't
But your stability, your base,
right.
was now crumbling.
It was, because that person who had the common interest or the common theme of what had happened to us.
You both got it.
Right.
Okay. So then you, what was the next step? He retired. You were self-medicating. You weren't getting the support you felt you needed.
Right.
And you were going through the system the way it is structured currently. What did you do next?
I talked to a few bosses who direct me back to the EAP. I gave the EAP a second chance. Again, they were helpful. They were empathetic, but nothing. I hadn't even been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress yet. I'm just going through the motions there.
And how long is this? 6 months? Nine months?
We're 6 months out now, okay. 8 months out. It was almost a full year that I found my own doctor through a friend who recommended this doctor who knows police culture, who knows post-traumatic stress, who actually gave me a written test and analyzed me through counseling, you know, through a session, and finally diagnosed me with post-traumatic stress. And once that happened, we started treating it. And I've said this to many people. I'm thoroughly convinced, had this been dealt with in a more timely fashion and addressed sooner instead of festering inside of me, I could have returned to work faster and more healthy for everybody, more healthy for myself, more healthy for the citizens, more healthy for my fellow officers. So for our department not to have a more thorough and more direct counseling session is a disservice to everybody.
And to have someone who's already trained, already has a lot of experience, it makes sense financially to get you the support you need and put you back on the street.
And that's one of the economic factors that I brought up to them. I said, you can pay in a lawsuit further down the line because this person is frustrated and they're coming to work stressed out every day because of their critical incident. And it doesn't even have to be a shooting. It doesn't have to be a car accident or anything, all the other horrific things. Just the cumulative things we do every day. I mean, picking up dead babies, the elderly, those are the biggest effects on us. But at some point, even going to these crime scenes and the gangbangers and everybody else shot, it's going to take its toll on you.
Certainly.
Unfortunately, people think that officers are robots. They think because you put a uniform on somebody and hang a badge and a gun on the badge on their chest and a gun on their hip, they're immune to all these stressors. It's just simply not true. And then for people to vilify the police officers when they do their job without even knowing the facts is just an added stressor that's not needed at all.
All right. So you at this point in the story, you've sought counseling on your own. Did you take yourself off of duty?
I did. One day I came to work. I went directly to our union, drove to our union hall on Washington Boulevard, walked in there, told them what was happening. They put me in reoccurrence of IOD. Excuse me.
Take your time.
That was probably the most difficult part of it, to walk in there and admit that I was having an issue.
Because you felt weakness.
Not necessarily weakness, but I knew I needed the help, and I wasn't getting it. I was frustrated, mm-hmm. because I'm like, okay, finally, they're like, okay, we're putting on reoccurrence of IOD, injured on duty from the original shooting, and this is said probably 9 months later. So I go to our medical section, and again, I have to take a step back. I do not want to beat up the department too badly, But because they do offer our survivors, they allow us to go talk to the recruits and trying to help change his culture. They do allow us to go to the Officer Ralph shooting class that's once a month at the academy and forge a relationship with these.
So they've developed some outlets.
They have.
We're getting there.
But I think... Dr. Cook, again, mentioned EAP. And
Dr. Cook, you've referenced twice. She was in our first segment. If you weren't able to listen to it, I invite you to take a listen.
She said she mentions a lot of things. There's lots of groups, the survivors, our chaplains ministry, our EAP. They all are great tools. But my suggestion to the department was let's all get together, look at the National Chiefs of Police outline, and all find our role in this so each officer has an outlet. Society in general, even non-police population, there's a stigma to mental health.
Right.
People do not want to admit that their loved one is suffering from any mental illness or that they're stressed out or that there's PTSD. People are stigmatized by it.
And people themselves don't want to admit it.
Correct.
If they even realize what's going on, which is a greater challenge. So the fact that you were aware of this, took action, and then walked into your peers and said, I'm seeking help, and I need to be off the streets.
Right. And I did that, and it was a relief because they were like, okay, go to the medical section. We have a medical section at our headquarters at 35th Street. And they are the clearinghouse. If you have any injury, physical injury related to your job, you go there and they help you find the doctors within their program to get you the help you need. She said the woman who was helping me there said, well, I talked to the people at the union, and it sounds as if you have post-traumatic stress. At that point, I heard the term, wasn't familiar enough with it, but agreed with her. Said, mm-hmm. That's probably a good place to start. She said, well, what doctor would you like to see? I said, well, isn't that your job? I said, I thought you were the medical section. Aren't you going to direct me to a doctor? She started Googling doctors. That's when I lost confidence once again. I couldn't believe
they didn't even have a Rolodex.
They didn't even have a group of doctors. And I talked to another officer who was in a shooting shortly after mine. They tried to send him to a pediatric psychiatrist. And they gave him the number. They just wanted to get him out of the office and send him away. And so he pulled out a cell phone and called up this number that they gave him before he left the office and said, hey, I'm a 40-year-old policeman involved in some trauma. And they're like, sorry, we can't help you.
No, but there would be doctors who have that specialization.
I've been told that they've added these doctors to the list and they've vetted doctors and they have them. I've offered. I said, can you please give them to me so we can post them on our website so people that may not be comfortable going through the EAP. There's officers that pay out of pocket. The doctors that we vetted say that the officers know they need help. We've had a huge influx in the last couple months because these officers are beaten. They're just reeling from the effects of all the police bashing.
Sure.
And if you look at the facts, police shootings in Chicago are down 40%. The police are not shooting unarmed black men to the rate that some people make you believe.
Or anybody in general. All right. So... let's we're gonna jump back again. Now you've gone through therapy for a year.
There was a director of our EAP at that time was getting ready to retire. Unfortunately, I think she was a little bit checked out. She saw her retirement date coming and maybe wasn't as thorough with her job. But I was the squeaky wheel. Mm-hmm. I knew that I needed help. I knew that I couldn't be the only officer out there that needed help. I said, please make me the poster boy for post-traumatic stress. I will go to roll calls. I will go do videos. I will do anything the department needs, but we need to address this problem.
Yeah, you've already owned it publicly.
Right. I've owned it.
You might as well.
Know.
Yeah.
And they refused that. At this point, the woman from the AP does find another doctor for me. So I'm seeing two doctors, one at Rush Hospital, who's written in journals for post-traumatic stress, has a contract with the... FBI, who's right up the road on mm-hmm. Roosevelt Road, he does their debriefings for their officers after critical incidents. He said he had approached the city many years ago saying, you probably have 25% to 30% of your officers have some form of post-traumatic stress. Maybe you want to start addressing this.
Which seems like it would be pretty consistent in at least larger town police forces.
Correct. It's everywhere in policing, but more so in a big city. Correct.
Yeah. When you come back to work... after you've been seeing counselors and going through therapy, what happened at this point?
I was off almost a full year. I was coming up to a no paid status. If I don't, I have two choices. I can ask for disability or I can come back to work. My choice was to come back to work. We put together, my doctors and I put together a protocol based on the National Chiefs of Police.
You're a cop.
Right.
That's what you do.
Right. We put together a protocol saying, this is what the National Chiefs slowly implemented me back in by putting me on desk duty, monitoring me. If I'm being short with somebody who's coming in to make a simple report and I'm, you know, being stressed out and not treating that person well, probably not quite ready to go on the street. So that's one of the simple things. Then if you monitor that person for a couple of weeks as they're on the desk, then you say, okay, they're ready to go hit the street. Put them with a veteran officer who knows that their history. You don't just throw them to somebody and say, hey, you know, they have to know that this person was involved in the shooting. We're implementing back on the street. Are you willing to work with this officer?
Right.
And there are plenty of officers out there who would do it. But you need to let them know so that they're looking for this thing. Am I overreacting? Am I underreacting? Am I acting appropriately?
Mm-hmm.
Am I escalating situations? Those are the type of things that you need to monitor. If you do these things and you help the officer, and continuous, not just a one-time trip to EAP, anybody can go through a doctor and say, no, I'm good, thank you, I'm leaving.
Especially if you're trying to get back on the street.
Right. Yeah. Right. So if it's mandatory that you go immediately after your critical incident, your shooting, then 6 months, then a year, then maybe the things that you told them weren't experienced. The second time, you're a little more comfortable with that doctor, and you're saying, you know what, I am still having trouble sleeping. I am having the flashbacks. I am short-tempered. All my relationships are failing because I'm so stressed out.
Mm-hmm.
Policing is if nothing else, please take away from this that police officers are human beings. We're not robots. There was a most recent high-profile case where the attorney said something to the effect, the attorney for the offender shot by the police said something to the effect, if the police officer can't handle doing that, he shouldn't be a police officer. My question to him, or my statement back to him, would be careful what you wish for. If you want a department full of members who can pull a trigger and shoot somebody and not have any feelings about that, be careful what you wish for, because I don't think anybody wants that.
We don't need non-empathetic people policing.
And officers are. We take this job to help people. I can guarantee you, if you go into the police academy right now, if there's a class starting today and you say, why did you take this job? Resounding, I took this job to help people. And it's difficult to go and help people every day when the communities a lot of times don't want your help, because you go in there. The first experience with a police officer is there's a domestic in the house. The police officer comes, mommy and daddy are fighting, one of them two has to go to jail, the officer arrests one of them, now what's that child's impression of police officers?
Right, they take
They're bad, they take away.
Away
my mom or dad. When the mom or dad come back from jail 2 days later or 3 days later after cooling off period, and they come back in that house, do they have that conversation with them saying, you know what, mommy and daddy had made a mistake, daddy was wrong, the police officer did his job? No.
No, they want to be.
Right. So now you have another generation tainted and skewed thinking the police are bad. We need ambassadors. We have wonderful, wonderful athletes in the city. We have wonderful actors and people that officer friendly with an ambassador of a celebrity. That the kids would be excited to see a celebrity walk in a room and then the celebrity say, this is my friend, a police officer. And a police officer would tell them what they do and say, we're here to help you. It's a simple, simple thing.
This is On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. I'm Hannah Stanley, and currently we are talking with Brian Warner, 18-year veteran of the Chicago Police Department, and founder of the organization Chicago Police Survivors. At this point in the story, Brian, you have been going through counseling for over a year, and now you are being brought back. You've put together a plan with your doctors to work your way back into
full-time
work. At some point, you were then taken off the force. Tell me how this happened.
It still dumbfounds me. When I first walked in there and asked for help, had they said, Brian, we're so glad that you asked for the help. In the meantime, while you're getting your help, here's a temporary ID. So if you need to go to the police station for anything or stop in to use the facilities, the workout room or something in another police station other than your own where people don't recognize you, you have that afforded
access,
to you.
Access, yeah.
Right. So, but in the meantime, get yourself better. Don't take any police action. As difficult as that would have been to hand over my badge and my ID that I carried with me for almost 20 years, I would have been able to do it. But to ask for the help and not be able to receive it from the department, then go out and seek it on my own and go through the trials and tribulation of doctors and finding the person that can help me. And then when that person and I put together a plan to bring me back, that's when they call psych you. Mm-hmm. They bring me upstairs at headquarters, take my badge, my ID away. They strip me of my police powers and say, well, that's the way we do it. I said, what's the sense? What is the reasoning behind this?
And so you had your badge and your ID while you were
correct.
Off duty.
And without incident.
So then when you come back, then right. they take it away.
Correct.
Okay. And all right. So obviously I can only assume that was devastating.
It was. And my
because
doctor,
you're like, wait, I've been doing work to right. make this better.
Right. And I said that all those same things to the person who was taking my badge away. And I said, you are part of the problem. I said, if you can't recognize how this is affecting officers, you should be ashamed of yourself. I said those very words to him. I said, we need to treat our officers better. I said, the department's done some great things. Put another helicopter in the air, put more boats on the water, built new police stations, given us new SUVs, more firepower and our rifles. What have they done for the individuals who are doing all those things? Your most important asset is your officer. You need to have their well-being at their well-being has to be the number one priority, and unfortunately, it's not.
Okay, so based on this experience, you channeled it in an incredibly excellent way, where you organized and founded Chicago Police Survivors. Tell me about that organization.
I have to give credit to Steven Tyler, who's an officer who was involved in a shooting many years ago, and he initially started the group. So I resurrected it. I reached out to Steve, and he told me what their goals were at the time. And same thing, when he went through his critical incident, he was involved in a shooting, almost died from his injuries. When he was coming back to work, he was having all these emotions and all these stressors, and he had nowhere to turn to. So he started the group originally, and then it went by the wayside when Phil Klein and the police memorial came around. They couldn't compete with them financially and for the recognition. So the natural process was to approach Phil and go under his umbrella, the memorial, and that's who currently sponsors us. They support our website. They support our phone that I carry with me 24 hours. We send out mailings to officers after their critical incidents, introducing ourselves and letting them know the resources we have for them and their families. I said, we also go to the police academy. That's the number one thing we're trying to do is get to the academy before these officers get on the street and tell them the current environment in policing is to try and laugh it off and macabre, police humor, which only will take you so far, right. or to go have a couple beers and try and forget about it. At some point, these, things that you see every day, I said, even if you never get to the point, I hope you never get to the point where you have to be involved in a shooting or take a life or be shot at. But even the just day-to-day things are going to stress you out. And it's in your best interest to seek the help and ask for the help, because nobody's going to ask you, hey, how you doing after seeing those three dead bodies? As most recent as a couple weeks ago when that whole family was killed mm-hmm. in their home. Seven victims. Every single officer that went there was affected, some differently than others. But I do have hope because I over the weekend I did hear that one of the bosses had the courage to go there and set up a meeting with EAP, our employee assistants, and those officers, and have them go in there and talk about their experience there and try and get some. So we are making strides,
seeing,
but we're a long way away.
We're seeing a shift in culture.
We are.
It's tiny.
Right. But the number one thing, it's a three-prong system that I've been asking for since I began this. Roll call training, saying, one, have one of our survivors who are open to telling their stories, go to roll call and say, this is the horrific thing that happened to me. This is how I dealt with it. It wasn't a healthy way, but now we have resources for you to get there. So you have the story of somebody who's been through a critical incident. Secondly, you have a clinician, a doctor, somebody from EAP who's been vetted that knows police culture, that's not going to get an officer jammed up and have their FOID card taken away, have them, stripped of their police powers and set them back even further in their recovery.
Handle it with some dignity.
Right. Okay. Handle it with some dignity. And thirdly, and probably most important, is an administrator, commander or above, from the department to say, we want you to ask for this help. We are not going to discipline you for asking for this help. It is in your best interest and our best interest, everyone's best interest, the community, the police department, your families, yours. Everybody's going to gain by you being a healthier, more productive employee. So please ask for this help. They're paying for it one way or the other.
Right.
Yeah, pay up front and have a more productive, happy employee, or pay in the long run because this officer is so stressed out, does something silly, and there's a lawsuit.
And long term, and we've referred briefly to the stigma of mental health and the need for
and it's tenfold,
for healthcare.
It's tenfold in policing because we are macho. We are providers. We are the fixers. We are the healers. And for us to have to ask for help, it's very, very difficult.
But it might then, if it does become the culture where help is the norm,
sure,
and understanding that people need to work through things,
right,
this might change the regular general population,
sure,
stigma.
Sure. And there's other departments, San Diego, Texas, places where there's military bases where these military people transition into law enforcement. They know they're great people because they can be trained. They dedicated to their country. They have a great background, but they may be carrying a little bit of baggage because of the things they saw while serving. And they address that. As they introduce them into the police department, they say, okay, are you healthy enough? Have you, you know, dealt with the things you saw in combat? If they say yes, then they you know, cycle them into the police department and continually monitor them. And they're existing officers who have never had a military experience. They recognize it. And they're proactive
because
with
they see it amongst themselves, and they also are used to. There's a norm of getting treatment or working through this that is different. Tell me how you got involved with Adler University.
Dr. Cook, how did we finally? She reached out to me because the Survivors Group was having one of our events, and she now they give us a couple of their interns each time we do our event, and they help us with our website. I'm not technically savvy at all, and they do a great job updating our website and doing all a lot of putting together programs for us that we can introduce to our officers, PowerPoint presentations that we can use at the academy. It's just a great relationship. And that's what I said. Adler's been a great resource for the Survivors Group. Phil Klein in a Police Memorial has been a great resource financially. Father Dan in our Police Chaplains Ministry. The folks of the AP with limited resources do a great job. But I said we need to combine the efforts and really put forth that combined effort into solving this problem. And I don't, like I said, the programs are out there. It's just implementing them and doing the right thing for our officers and for our community. A healthier officer is going to be a much better servant of the community.
Well, I will say most frequently when I talk to someone in the service or when I talk to a police officer, fire department, I always thank them for their work and for their bravery. And in this incident, I have to say thank you for your bravery and what you're doing now, because this is something that is it would be challenging for many people to come forward and take that stand and say,
well,
I need
you.
Help, and others might also.
I would hope that everybody listening today takes that message as well. I think after 9/11, of my 18 years in the police department, it was only probably a week after 9/11 did we see that recognition, because they saw what those police and fire officers, the first responders, did when that horrific thing was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, well, if something happens here, these are going to people that have been doing it for us.
Absolutely.
So they were shaking your hand, buying you a coffee. If you had lunch, you had a sandwich. You'd go to pay your bill and say, oh, that person, you know, left already. They don't want your thanks, but they bought you a sandwich. We're the same police officers.
And you didn't get into it for
right.
that.
No. I said, we're the same police officers. We're doing the same things every day, but there's a small minority, and I'm not sure what the motivation is other than money to bash the police and vilify us. We're out there every day. We respond to hundreds and hundreds of jobs, whether it be domestic, whether it be negotiating a two neighbors quarreling, a disturbance in the park. We're engaging the community without incident, solving these problems and doing the best we can with it. So for when we're scrutinized for the handful of events and just bashed and bashed by the politicians, go on TV saying that my police department's corrupt, they're racist, and then try and show up to a roll call with a couple pizzas and say, oh, don't worry, guys, you're doing a great job. We can't have that. You need to be united and say our police have issues. We have our situations. We can certainly do more training. But our society and our culture have bigger issues that we need to all work together to solve, because we cannot keep continuing bashing and vilifying the police and making them the scapegoat for all these issues.
All right. Brian, thank you, one, again, for your work and for your service, and also for being here today and sharing your story. Brian Warner, 18-year veteran of the Chicago Police Department and founder of the organization Chicago Police Survivors. That is going to conclude this episode on social health and change brought to you by Adler University. Don't